From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
I love the movies, and I love history, and I love to read great books that combine expert film analysis, extensive knowledge of Hollywood history, and great writing laced with humor and wisdom. In other words, I love to read Scott Eyman. His books, all brilliant, include The Speed of Sound, Hollywood and the Talkie Revolution, 1926 to 1930. Print the Legend, The Life and Times of John Ford. Louis B. Mayer, Lion of Hollywood. Empire of Dreams, The Epic Life of Cecil B. DeMille. John Wayne, The Life and Legend. Hank and Jim, The 50-Year Friendship of Henry Fonda and James Stewart. 20th Century Fox, Daryl F. Zanuck and the Creation of the Modern Film Studio. And Charlie Chaplin versus America, When Art, Sex, and Politics Collided. His new book is Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. Scott Eyman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be here.
Well, after having read your credits, I'm afraid we're out of time, but thank you so much. For...
I feel exactly the same way.
Well, I'm so glad that you have written so many books, and I love them so much. They're great. And this one kind of draws from many of your previous books, including the book that you wrote with Robert Wagner.
There's a page about that derives from RJ's book. That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Well, I think what makes Joan Crawford most interesting is the fact that she doesn't just exist in one era of Hollywood. I mean, she was there with Lon Chaney and Harry Langdon, and she was directed by Steven Spielberg.
Exactly. It's a 50-year, almost a 50-year career. Truly amazing. Mostly on a very high level as well.
And she had to kind of weather many storms, right at the beginning of her career, really, was the revolution of sound, which you wrote a great book about. To what degree was sound a catastrophe for the film industry?
Well, they had to reinvent how they told stories. Silent movies were mostly visual, except for in titles that explained what the characters were saying to one another. In an 8-reel picture, the titles would probably take up 2 to 3 reels. That meant 5 to 6 reels were purely visual. So a lot of the story and most of the drama and certainly, the star quality came strictly through photography and art direction. So, you could make the case that, sound, changed not just technique, but acting technique, but it also changed motion picture technique to a great deal. It took a long time for sound films to recapture the visual splendor of the late silent era. You know, and by the late 30s and early 40s, they'd gotten it. But the early sound period can be pretty rough sometimes when you're watching it. I just, Turner Classic Movies ran His Glorious Night a couple weeks ago, John Gilbert's first talkie. And a lamentable production in every conceivable way. Basically, it's just medium shots of people talking for 75 or 80 minutes. And it's stupefyingly dull. And that's not atypical. But this was a major picture by a major studio with a major star directed by Lionel Barrymore, who had no business behind the camera. And there are occasions when he had no business in front of the camera either, but we won't go into that. But it's a horrifying picture. And it's not atypical for films made in 1929 and 1930, and 1931 as well.
I saw a Ronald Colman picture. I think it was his first talkie. I'm not sure. But they used sound in the same way that 3D filmmakers use 3D, like we're going to have things flying at you for no reason because this movie is in 3D. And they had the whole opening of the picture was a bunch of sounds, bells ringing and
right,
dishes clanking, all kinds of stuff. Right. Just like, hey, look.
Because the audience couldn't hear those at home. To hear them coming from a movie screen would be just a thrill for the audience. And perhaps it actually was. I mean, you can't overlook the fact that seeing actors they had only seen mouthing words to actually hear the voices that went with the personalities was enormously exciting. You know, and in some cases, their voices matched perfectly. Ronald Colman, Laurel and Hardy, And in some cases, the voices didn't match perfectly, and careers were irremediably shortened.
How much of that was, you know, the end of, say, John Gilbert's career or Clara Bow? How much it was due to the natural kind of changing of the guard that happens in Hollywood, and how much was due to their voices, and how much was due to just bad movies like Lionel Barrymore's direction there?
Yes, in all cases. Well, Gilbert had only been a star really since 1923, 1924. So he's in 1929, he's been a star for, say, 6 years. But he had a huge run with the pictures like The Big Parade and the La Boheme with Lillian Gish, and everything he was in made money. And the Garbo pictures he co-starred with. So he was a huge star. He was MGM's leading man, major leading man. So I don't think they saw it coming, you know. And there's nothing actually wrong with his voice. There's a great deal wrong with how he was presented, and how he sailed into things without realizing that the rules of the game had just changed. But nobody realized the rules of the game had just changed, really. He sails into it like he's John Gilbert, and everything he touches is gold. And, oh, by the way, I'm wonderful, and this movie's going to be wonderful, and you'll love it. And it's a terrible film with a terrible script. And he didn't sound like what the audience thought he should sound like. And that happened with a number of people. It happened with Douglas Fairbanks Sr., who's glorious in silent films. But his voice, it's not a bad voice. He was a stage actor. He'd worked successfully in New York theater. So he didn't have a bad voice. But he tended to bark his lines. And he didn't sound like what the audience thought he should sound like, obviously. So his career in sound came to – and he was getting older as well. He was starting to push 50 by that time, which is tough for a dynamic, athletic leading man. But Gilbert was actually in the prime of his life. Gilbert was – what was he? He was about 34, 35. But his career got spavined and limped along for a few more years. Garbo got him back for Queen Christina, and he's fine in Queen Christina. Same voice, but you can see his self-confidence is not quite there. He's a little shaky emotionally, apparently. And he drank himself to death, basically, because he couldn't deal with change. But not everybody sounded like Ronald Colman. Not everybody sounded like Laurel and Hardy. You know, there were people whose voices just didn't jibe with what they looked like. And no, Norma Talmadge did not have a Brooklyn accent. Her voice is perfectly okay. It just doesn't have much bouquet, doesn't have much flavor. You can tell that she's trying very hard not to have a Brooklyn accent.
Well, you wrote a book about Louis B. Mayer, Scott Eyman, and so you must know the answer to this question. The sort of apocryphal story is that Louis B. Mayer had a fight with John Gilbert. John Gilbert punched him. And so Louis B. Mayer tanked his career. Is that a true story or no?
I don't think the studio tanked his career. They were paying him $250,000 a picture. And for him to tank his career, basically everybody at the studio plus Nick Schenck, the chairman of the board at Lowe's Incorporated, would have had to go along with it and say, yeah, give him terrible scripts. No, I don't think they gave him terrible scripts. They gave him terrible films when he was making silent hits. A movie called Desert Nights, which was made in 28 or 29, a silent film. It's really a cheater. It's a total piece of garbage. And the studio should have been embarrassed to release it with a major star. It's even cheap looking. So a star in that era was expected to carry weak pictures. They all couldn't be gems. Okay. And after his glorious night, they released actually the first picture Gilbert shot, which they thought was terrible, and they reshot a lot of it, called Redemption. And it's dull. He's not bad, actually. It's a Tolstoy story. It's just not an interesting picture, and he's dull. So I think the mistake they made was in material, frankly. I don't think it was intentional. I think it was just one of those things that happened in Hollywood when you're rejiggering and you've got 15 or 20 major stars, and you've got to come up with appropriate material for each one of them, theoretically, and you don't always do it.
With Clara Bow, I think it was in Bud Schulberg's book that he says that because Clara Bow was a star and that people would go see her in anything, they would hold back good pictures for other actresses and put Clara Bow in bad pictures because they knew people would go see them just because Clara Bow was in them. Is that
sure?
Make sense? Yeah,
sure. Yeah, there are stars that that carried a lot of bad pictures. There are stars that carry a lot of bad pictures today. That's a star's job, basically. With a studio, but this is not the studio system now. The studio system has been interred at Forest Lawn for a long time. the system then, a star would make two or three pictures a year, typically. And, you know, over 4 or 5 years, there'd be a couple good pictures in there. There'd be a couple mediocre pictures in there, and there'd be a couple stiffs. That's just the way, that was the way it was done. You know, you couldn't come up with, two or three good stories for Greta Garbo every year. It just wasn't possible. Or for that matter, John Gilbert, especially because you wanted to showcase them the way the audience wanted to see them. You didn't want to reinvent the wheel if you had a big movie star. You want to reinforce that wheel with a big movie star. Because once a movie star hits big, you tend to replicate that movie star. That's why there's Ocean's 11, Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13, undoubtedly Ocean's 14 at some point. You know, that's always the nature of show business.
You talked a lot about Clark Gable in this book because, of course, Gable and Joan Crawford made a lot of pictures together, and I'm waiting for your Clark Gable biography. I'm hoping that's coming next. But you mentioned that Gable would never play a murderer, and I was thinking about that, about how the studios used their performers, because when he wasn't at MGM and he made The Misfits, which I think is one of the most honest performances and like a bare performance of.
Oh, it's a wonderful performance. He's great at it. He proved he could act.
Yeah.
And not just play Gable. He actually proved he could act. And he's wonderful in The Misfits. Absolutely.
Yeah. So was his reluctance to play a murderer his own or the studio's?
Yes. But you know, when he was in the theater before he got in the movies, he played Killer Mears in a movie called, I'm blanking on the title. It wasn't a movie. I'm sorry, it wasn't a movie. He did it on stage where he played a crazed psychopathic killer in prison, and he was very good. But when you see pictures of him from that performance, we're talking 1928. When you see pictures of him in that performance, he doesn't really look like Clark Gable. His teeth haven't been fixed. His hair is not cut right, you know, and he's got a 4-day, 5-day stubble because he's supposed to look like a tough killer. You know, it just doesn't look like Clark Gable. But when you see him in pictures where he's taking command and ordering people around, you can see him playing that part. But the Gable that MGM created incrementally, you know, where you see traces of it in movies like Possessed with Crawford, and he starts to come into focus with Red Dust, I think, you know, even though he doesn't have a mustache in Red Dust. But with the addition of the mustache, because Gable, as I say in the book, Gable looked good wearing a tux. Gable looked good wearing denim. It didn't matter. Gable simply looked good because he had a face for the movies, he had the head for the movies, and he had the body for the movies. And he had the attitude, that take charge attitude. That John Wayne had the same take charge attitude. Audiences like that. It gives the audience a sense of security. If the hero of the picture knows what he's doing, then we can relax. It's not a Hitchcock picture where the hero is going basically like, oh, shit. You know, where Cary Grant is running for his life in cornfields, and Jimmy Stewart's hanging off of a tower in San Francisco. You know, those are different kinds of movies from different kinds of filmmakers. With Gable, you don't get that. You get a sense of security, and even in The Misfits, you get a sense of security. That Gay Langland, his character in The Misfits, knows who he is. See, that's the baseline for a Gable character. He's a man who knows who he is, and he knows the score.
Well, you know, that's a common thing that people say about the classic Hollywood actors. Well, they, you know, he's always the same. And they say that about John Wayne in particular. And yet, you know, I mean, I think that is not in any way true because, you know, there's a huge difference between the character he plays in True Grit and the character he plays in In Harm's Way or whatever.
Sure, absolutely.
But they bring an iconography of who they are to those roles. And that's why maybe you feel a certain feeling when you see Gable in The Misfits, even though he's nothing like the Gable in China Seas.
But the rule of thumb in that era, and occasionally in our era as well, is to develop a persona, especially with male actors, more male actors more than female actresses. There's a certain, if you go to see a Gary Cooper movie, you kind of know who he's going to be. You know, you kind of know what Gable's going to be in a Gable movie. Now, it's not that with act. You don't know where Irene Dunne's going to come from in a particular picture. She's probably not going to play a prostitute. We know that. But Stanwyck, on the other hand,
can do that. She'll go for it.
She'll go for it. Yeah. The actresses had more leeway, it seems to me, in the studio era. A lot more leeway in parts than actors did, major actresses had more leeway than major actors did.
I think the scene to me that epitomizes what Joan Crawford is in the movies is in Grand Hotel. In Grand Hotel, she plays a stenographer who draws the interest of a titled gentleman in the opening of the picture, and she thinks maybe she'll have a date with him, and he's very fresh with her, which is she's sort of delighted by. And then it doesn't turn out that way. By the time she makes her date with him, he's fallen in love with Greta Garbo. And then she's kind of ends up becoming a sex worker. She's agreed to go and be the companion.
A mistress.
And he says, he puts his hand on her, Wallace Beery, who's like so repugnant compared to Clark Gable, puts his hand on her shoulder while she's kind of, I don't know, she's polishing a shoe or something, and says, "You're going to be nice to me, aren't you?" Mm-hmm. And she doesn't look at him or even look away from her shoe, but says, "Yes." Just kind of resigned to this fate.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot going on in her face in that scene. And I think that's what Joan Crawford could bring to a role. She's very naturalistic and a lot happening behind her eyes.
Well, she never trained as an actress. She didn't intend to be an actress. She wanted to be a dancer. that was her ambition. She'd never acted in her life before. And she was a dancer in some, choruses in the Midwest. And she was, 19, 20 years old at that point. Then she gets hired by the Schuberts. and she spends a year in New York in chorus lines for the Schuberts. But as she said late in her life, with honesty that I really find very touching, she said, "I wasn't good enough for the first line. I was in the second line." Well, you got to give her props, for honesty. And when you see her in musicals, clearly she loves to dance. I mean, she just loves to dance. She's not really very good. She picks them up and lays them down, and that's fine. But it meant a lot to her. But when she gets to MGM, they're not making a lot of musicals and silent films.
Yeah, right.
It didn't work out. So she had to learn how to act. So she starts basically learning by doing, and that's a tough way to learn when your whole you're 20 years old, 21 years old. And your whole life is flashing in front of you. And if you don't convert this opportunity, it's back to the chorus line in Chicago, So there's a lot riding on it. And she learned fast. She learned fast. She when you look at those early pictures she did at Metro, she doesn't look like herself. Her hair is a little, it's got a kinky perm to it, which doesn't help. You can't, her cheekbones don't pop. She's heavier than she would be. So she figured out and she listened, and she listened to people that knew what they were talking about, like John Arnold, the head cameraman at MGM. She lost 15 or 20 pounds, which made her cheekbones pop out and made her eyes slightly larger as well. And that made a huge difference. And working with Lon Chaney was crucial for her in The Unknown.
That's a crazy picture.
It's a great picture. It's a great, great picture. And in most Chaney pictures, I've said this before, but it bears repeating. In most Lon Chaney pictures, the girl is just the girl. You don't. Mary Philbin is just the girl in the Phantom of the Opera. She has no particular personality, and she's not terribly interesting. Patsy Ruth Miller is the girl in The Hunchback of Notre Dame. They put just generic ingenues opposite Chaney, you know, generally. But Crawford in The Unknown is much more than just the girl. She's very riveting, and she holds the screen with Chaney, which very few actresses could do, because Chaney's a great actor. He's a big, great actor, but he's a great actor. Very charismatic, very original, and daring, a really daring actor. He uses his entire body. It's almost Del Sarte. But in the Unknown, she holds the screen with Lon Chaney. And I'm sure around the studio, they said, take a look at her. Take a look at this. Take a look at these scenes. Because your eye just doesn't go to Chaney. Your eye also goes to her. And that's unusual for a Lon Chaney picture. And she said Lon Chaney was the single greatest influence in her professional life, because he taught her, the phrase she used is, he taught me the difference between standing in front of a camera and acting. And without him, I don't know that she would have made it, frankly, because you have to project something. You have to bring some kind of intensity, some kind of electricity to the lens. And Chaney always did that, and she always did that as well.
Well, I would think in The Unknown, in particular, of all of Chaney's pictures, he needs a female star that will do that, because, you know, he makes some crazy sacrifices in this movie, and he wouldn't do it for just a generic female star. It had to be somebody riveting.
Yeah. But they didn't know that, I don't think, going in. I think they saw it during the production of the film. It was only a 5 or 6 week shoot. I mean, the Chaney pictures, unless it's Phantom of the Opera or Hunchback of Notre Dame, the MGM pictures were shot very expeditiously, and they were extremely profitable. I mean, Lon Chaney made $1 million a year in profits for MGM every year. I mean, he was probably the most valuable star they had in terms of pure box office, and they weren't terribly expensive. He was the only heavy salary on those pictures. They could make a Chaney picture for $300,000. $400,000, and they would gross 2-3 times that. So he was golden, and he liked to work. He'd make, you know, 3-4 pictures a year. So he was golden as far as the studio was concerned. But that was, I think, the turning point in Crawford's career at MGM, because you can see the face emerging. You can see the actress emerging all at once, you know? And after that, she starts to pick up some momentum as more than just another $75 a week ingenue.
We're chatting with Scott Iman, and his new book is a biography of Joan Crawford called Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face. So Joan Crawford not only jumped the hurdle of talking pictures, but she also weathered the revolution of acting that occurred in the late 40s and early 50s with Montgomery Clift and Brando and James Dean, where the style of acting really changed. Mm-hmm. And when I'm looking back at our Dancing Daughters, one of her early silent pictures, she's very naturalistic in that movie.
She is.
She seems to already have that kind of the fact that she didn't train as an actress, nevertheless, she had a natural talent for it.
Yeah. I think she did, when she felt safe, and she was beginning to feel safe by that time, because that comes after the Chaney picture, and she's already picking up. And Our Dancing Daughters is also built around her. You know, she's the star of the picture.
She does that stage dive. It's like it's very contemporary. She's dancing, and even though it's a silent picture, she's dancing. She's doing the Charleston, then she just throws herself off the stage into the arms of all the people below.
Right. No, it's a good picture. I think it holds up very well. The print is not great. I'd love to see it get a run through and get restored a little bit, so it's a little better. But maybe this is the best they can do. But she was beginning to pick up momentum with that picture, because it's clearly built for her, to showcase her, in the same way that The Unknown is basically built to showcase Lon Chaney. And so that's I think that gave her the confidence, because she would have known that this is my shot. If I don't convert this, they'll probably give me one more chance, and then they won't give me another chance. You know, she'd been there a couple of years by that time, and she knew how the studio operated by that time. how all the studios operated by that time. They didn't stick with you indefinitely. You know, they had to see something either on the screen or at the box office, and preferably both.
Well, when this revolution of acting that I was mentioning came along in the 50s, was that something that we look at retrospectively and say there was a revolution, or were people aware of it then? And if so, how did people like Joan Crawford feel about it?
Oh, they were aware of it then because it had been written about heavily. The group theater had been heavily covered in the 30s and 40s when actors like John Garfield came to Hollywood. Mm-hmm. They were completely different. And I mean, I love Garfield. I think he died at 39. My God, what would he have accomplished had he lived? But what I love about him is he's always vaguely pissed off. You never noticed that?
Yeah.
He's always got a thing on his shoulder, and he's daring you to knock it off. I love that about him. But that's not a quality you got in classic era Hollywood in the 20s and 30s. It's just not. But that came out of the proletarian bent of the group theater to reflect reality, both in the script and in the acting. And that you can draw a straight line from Garfield to Brando and Streetcar, you know, and Montgomery Clift was also fascinating. Now, he's a more romantic figure than Garfield, or because he's beautiful. I mean, he's just stunning to look at, and he's smaller, and he's obviously gentler, a gentler personality than Brando or Garfield. But I mean, to me, that's the triumvirate of the group theater conquering 20th century acting, basically, and obliterating everything that came before. But, and there's a positive side to that, and there's also a negative side to that. You know, it's great at playing reality and aspects of reality. It's not really good at playing musical comedy, swashbucklers, you know, stylized entertainments. That's not a gift they have or had. So those genres gradually petered out because people didn't have the right attitude, the right je ne sais quoi. Attitude that an earlier generation of actors could summon without any problems.
So you're saying the musical died because the style of acting changed?
Not the musical. No, I don't think musicals changed that much. The personalities that inhabited and enlarged musicals changed. Barbara Streisand wouldn't have been a star in 1945. Barbara Streisand wouldn't have been a star in 1935. Barbara Streisand's timing was perfect to be a star. But Louis B. Mayer would have rushed out of a screening room in horror looking at the screen test of Barbara Streisand. There's just no way, you know. But what I'm talking about is middle of the road drama, you know. Musicals, they still survive. They make one once in a while, you know. Look at Wicked. You know, if you want to, it's not my thing. my wife dragged me to the New York show. This is 15 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And I was bored out of my skull. It didn't impact me at all. But obviously I'm in a minority.
And the movie is twice as long because there's two movies. It takes two movies.
Oh, God. I'd rather open a vein, actually.
But, I mean, there are musicals that you like.
Oh, God, right? Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. So it's not like you're opposed to the genre. I mean, you're not opposed to any genre, right? I mean, if a movie is good.
No, if you love movies, movies are made out of genres.
Yeah.
You know, a Western's a Western, a gangster picture's a gangster picture, a love story's a love story. You kind of know where it's going in the first 25 minutes, you know, by the tone that they set. Now, there are surprises sometimes. They'll cross you up. But not that often, not that often. The genres haven't changed that much. There's been the addition of genres, you know, spandex movies with superheroes. That really wasn't a big deal in the 30s or 40s. Mm-hmm. That started in the 50s when comic books gradually gained momentum, you know, Superman and all those shows. And they were very successful. And they continue to be very successful. And I have no problem with them. Yeah, I don't particularly like them. Uh-huh. It's not my thing.
Well, there's an argument, I think, that was put out by maybe it was Francis Ford Coppola or somebody, that the Marvel movies are not cinema.
Mm-hmm.
He's not saying that they're not entertaining. He's just saying that they don't count.
Well, there's nobody ever dies. If they die, they come back, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, there's no real sense of drama or threat, it seems to me. You know, it's just, it's a kabuki kind of theater, very stylized kabuki kind of theater, where nobody really dies. And there's certain tropes that the audience accepts because they know that they're not really going to kill off the franchise because they're making too much money. Now, if the franchise begins to deteriorate, they might actually kill somebody off, wait 3 or 4 years and then try to reboot it, you know,
right.
But they're never going to kill off the franchise as long as there's any money to be made.
Well, that leads me to the most recent James Bond movie. Did you see it? And were you surprised when James Bond, spoiler alert, listeners, James Bond dies in the end of the film?
Yeah, I thought it was stupid. I mean, I didn't understand why. Uh-huh. It didn't offend me. I mean, I'm not heavily invested in James Bond. I just thought it was stupid. Now, you can easily just cast a younger actor. And James Bond goes to work for MI5, you know, at the age of 27 or something.
Yeah.
And you just repeat the cycle all over again. But I didn't really, or you can pretend it was all a bad dream.
That's what they're going to do. It's a dream.
It was all a dream. It was Daniel Craig's dream to get out of the part and make him happy to do one more film. They promised to kill him off. I don't know. But it just struck me as stupid from the part and point of view of the Broccolis. Why would they do that? This is the foundation of their empire and their fortune, and they're going to kill off their main character. You don't shoot the Lone Ranger. I mean,
that's very interesting. There's a period in Joan Crawford's career that kind of coincides with The Blacklist and the coming of television, where her career kind of slows down, and you think, well, maybe that's it for Joan Crawford, mm-hmm. although mm-hmm. it's not. She's got a whole lot more to go. But how did The Blacklist in particular affect her, if it did? Seems like it.
It didn't affect her at all. She was apolitical. A friend of hers told me, Franchot Tone's son, Pat, who knew her very well, because she and Tone divorced in 1937 or 8. And when she moved to New York in 1955 for the rest of her life, Tone had already moved to New York by that time, and they reconnected, and she would have Franchot and Pat over for dinner once a month at her house, and she would, at her apartment, she would cook herself. She was a very good cook. And she would have parties, and she would invite them, and he said, nominally, he said, how do you put it? He said, Joan was a Republican, but she didn't care about politics at all. You know, so she was a nominal Republican. Probably what we call an Eisenhower Republican would be my guess. So it didn't really, the Blacklist didn't really impact her, I don't think. What really impacted her was what she found offensive. She was carefully edging into Grand Dame territory in the early 50s, and she was offended by Marilyn Monroe. And Marilyn's, what she thought was Marilyn's obvious pushing of, you know, the low cut blouses and all that. She thought that was unseemly. So the woman who'd made Our Dancing Daughters in 1958, was a little bit offended by Niagara in 1953. But that's crazy, again, yeah. Everybody gets, I suppose a lot of people get more conservative as they get older. You know, but she didn't like the obvious display of assets, even though she had displayed her assets, although probably not as blatantly.
Well, we're talking with Scott Eyman. His new book is a biography of Joan Crawford. There's a single film that I think destroyed the reputation of two actresses, and that was Mommy Dearest. It destroyed the reputation of Faye Dunaway, who was considered a pretty good actress before she chewed up the scenery in that picture. And it destroyed the reputation of Joan Crawford until your book came along. How much validity is there to Mommy Dearest?
Well, I tried to walk a tightrope on that. Crawford adopted four children. Two of them she disinherited in her will. Two of them she left money to. The two she left money to insisted that nothing that took place in the book Mommy Dearest ever actually happened. That said, that it was, you know, basically an act of revenge on the part of Christina, Crawford's oldest child. So what I elected to do was basically see what other people who observed the family said and draw conclusions from that. In other words, what actually transpired. And there were a lot of, it's not that people weren't in and out of the house. The children were very much part of Crawford's life. She traveled with them. So I focused on what people saw outside of the immediate family circle. And, you know, it came down to a lot of people thought the book was ridiculous. The film certainly was ridiculous. The odd thing about the movie is it's actually a very faithful adaptation of the book.
Yeah.
But by adapting the book so faithfully, I think it exposed the absurdity that the book is basically built on. It's fair to say that she did not have a natural bent, I think, for parenting. I think that's fair to say. As I write in the book, it's as if she'd never seen the way an actual family, a semi-normal family, because who knows what's normal, but a semi-normal family operates. And in fact, she hadn't. She hadn't. Her own upbringing was grossly compromised in every conceivable way. There were a succession of daddies moving through the house at all times. She and her mother were not close. Her mother bartered her daughter's labor for the daughter's education. As a result, she really didn't get much of an education at all. She only had one semester of college, and she had to drop out because she was way over her head. And she regretted it, I think, to the end of her life. So basically, she emerged at the age of 17 or 18. She could read. She could write. She could do her math. But she didn't really have any sense of family, of how people act in groups. And she was improvising in that respect for a lot of her life.
Well, she would take direction in the movies. Did she ever think, oh, I'll tie my son's arms and legs to the bed so he doesn't suck his thumb? Did she ever think I should consult a child psychologist or Dr. Spock or...
Yeah,
he wasn't around then. But, you know what I'm asking. Did she ever look for anybody else's advice on raising her?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't think so. I think she felt she'd done pretty well for herself, and her gifts might even extend to child rearing.
There's also a lot made about her feud with Bette Davis is a television series about it.
Yeah, and I watched it,
and
it's terrible, and it's all bullshit too for the most part. The whole thing about whatever happened to Baby Jane, which put a lot of money in Crawford's pocket because she had a percentage, and it put a lot of money in Bette Davis's pocket because she had a percentage, and they both were at a low point in their careers at that point. So it was a Hail Mary that actually they both caught. But a lot of the stuff that's been written about that book is simply fan fiction. It has no relation to reality. I mean, the TV show, for instance, there's a scene where, Crawford is unburdening herself to Hedda Hopper, and they're like girlfriends. They didn't like each other at all. And Crawford would no more have told Hedda Hopper, how she felt about Bette Davis or anybody else, even off the record, because there was no intimacy. You can read, there's transcripts of interviews in Hopper's papers. Hopper's interviewing Crawford. And I mean, it is like, they're just fencing with each other. There's no intimacy, whatever. And there's no honesty, whatever. It's just boilerplate answers to boilerplate questions. And so to try to gin up some kind of relationship where none existed is just silly. But they needed a scene where she explains herself to somebody. So let's do it with Hedda Hopper. Well, no, Hedda Hopper would be the last person on earth she would talk to. And the animosity between them, as Robert, I went to Robert Aldrich's papers, which are voluminous, I might add, day by day of the production of all of his films. He kept everything, and it's all at UCLA. as he says, it's fair to say they detested each other, but they behaved perfectly because there was no time. This was a low budget picture. They had $900,000, and that's all, to make the movie. And the movie's 2 hours and 10 minutes. So it was, as I write in the book, it was a sprint. It was not a stroll. It was a sprint. They hadn't worked that fast since the 1930-32 era, where you turn out a picture in 5 or 6 weeks because the depression was on and they didn't want to spend any money. It was made very fast and very professionally, and there was no time for diva behavior. There really wasn't. The problem came on the follow-up, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte, which they both signed on to do. And by that time, Davis had been nominated for an Academy Award for Baby Jane and didn't win. Anne Bancroft won, and Crawford had accepted the award for Anne Bancroft, which Davis took, Bancroft was doing a play in New York. And Davis took that as a shot across the bow.
Yeah.
That, you know, and she was just enraged. And on Charlotte, she started making remarks and creating an unhappy set. And Crawford didn't deal with unhappy sets. She always wanted a happy set. She needed a positive environment in order to do good work. And Davis did. Davis was perfectly happy creating a stink.
Yeah.
And she created a stink, and Crawford got sick, and her white blood cell count shot up, and she got a terrible chesting thing, probably about as bad as mine right now. And she had to go to the hospital, and the hospital reports are all in Aldrich's papers. And she was sick, really sick. They were looking for leukemia. Her white blood cell count was so high, they were worried about leukemia. Actually, she was just had an infection, a probably psychosomatic infection. But she couldn't, she started missing days, and they shut the picture down for 2 weeks in order for her to, you know, recoup and get healthy so she could come back and shoot. And she came back for a couple days and then got sick again. So at that point, Aldrich had to make a decision, you know, and he started casting about, they were either going to shut the picture down and go for the insurance, which is going to be a nightmare. And the lawyers would be talking for years. Or recast Crawford's part. And the problem was Davis had actor approval in her contract. So Davis had to approve of the replacement. Well, Aldrich's first choice was Vivian Leigh. Well, Vivian Leigh's not going to make Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. I don't see any scenario where that would happen. And he's not sure if she ever saw the script. He wanted Katharine Hepburn. Davis would not accept Katharine Hepburn. And I don't think Katharine Hepburn would have made the movie either, frankly. She didn't need to. She's making Long Day's Journey into Night with Sidney Lumet. What does she want with, you know, Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte? And then he thought of Vivian Leigh, actually. And Leigh replied, it's very funny. Leigh replied, I could just about stand to be in a Louisiana swamp at 5 a.m. with Joan Crawford, but never with Betty Davis. So the actress that Davis would approve was Olivia de Havilland, who was an old friend of hers from the Warner Brothers days. Sure. So Aldrich got Olivia de Havilland, and she made the picture, and it made a little money, nowhere near as much money as Baby Jane, you know?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't as good as Baby Jane. Baby Jane is really
not as good as Baby Jane. Yeah. No, it's not. Although I kind of like it, it's more Grand Guignol than Baby Jane. Baby Jane starts out as kind of a weird comedy, and then it gets sad, you know. But it segues slowly from the grotesque comedy to something that's really dramatic. Whereas Sweet Charlotte is on a more funhouse level, I think. I like it when Bruce Dern's head comes bouncing down the stairs, though. I think that's a that's a moment I treasure.
Well, Betty Davis also didn't get along with Miriam Hopkins, so maybe she was much more inclined to have enemies among.
Yeah, but nobody got along with Miriam Hopkins.
Oh,
there was a long list of people that didn't get along with Miriam Hopkins. Wyler liked Miriam Hopkins a lot. He cast her right up to what the Children's Hour in the 60s.
Yeah.
But no, Errol Flynn hated Miriam Hopkins. I mean, everybody thought she was a terrible scene stealer. But Lubitsch also liked Miriam Hopkins. He thought she was adorable. But no, actors tended not to like her because she was a scene stealer, or they thought she was a scene stealer.
Mm. Well, although Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is really a good picture. I like it, and I think Joan Crawford's great in it. There's also, you know, Trog.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I mean, was that so Baby Jane kind of opened this door for horror as a vehicle for Joan Crawford? Was she, how did she feel about going down that road?
It was work, and work was very important to her. Work was, I think, the most important thing to her. I mean, if the studio started to burn down, she would have grabbed the cameras and run, you know, but she would have taken the camera with her. It was her identity. Work was her identity. And I mean, she knew that those William Castle pictures were William Castle pictures, and they're fun and they're sleazy and they're, you know, like a woman running with her throat cut, running down the street screaming. But she knew this was not Mildred Pierce. It's not Possessed. It's not, it's a different thing. And she knew that, but she also knew she was getting a percentage of the profits, and they paid off. And they paid off. And frankly, she needed the money. Yeah. She needed the money. She was not well off. She always lived very high, spent a lot of money. All of her wardrobes were haute couture. And she didn't go out of the house without looking like $5 million. So she had a high overhead. And she needed the money. And the work. And she didn't like television. See, she was friends with Loretta Young and Myrna Loy. And Loretta Young happily did a TV series for 9 or 10 years and made a great deal of money. But Crawford and most actresses of Crawford's generation, people like Irene Dunne, Stanwyck, they didn't trust television. It was hurry up and get it done. Hurry up and get it done. Hurry up and get it done. You know, James Wong Howe didn't shoot television. William Wyler didn't direct television. And they were used to getting the best technicians and the best directors they could. And so it felt cut rate to them. And I mean, Stanwyck did The Big Valley, but Stanwyck had tried TV in the 50s and it flamed. It didn't work at all. And she got a couple of years out of The Big Valley, but that was the roustabout period when she had to work. And she, you know, you can make people like cracks about Crawford and Trog and the William Castle pictures. But Jesus, I mean, you know, Stanwyck's working with Elvis Presley and Roustabout. These people, especially Stanwyck and Crawford, are a great deal alike. They came out of the same really grim backgrounds. Work was their identity. Work was how they justified their lives because their marriages were not successful. Their children, relationships with their children were not successful. What was left at the end of the day, at the end of the career, was the work, was the films. That was where they had to place their bets. So you do what you have to do in order to keep that bet going. Stanwyck did the same thing. She ends up doing the Colbys, for God's sake. Same thing. And I'm sure Crawford, if she'd lived longer, might have ended up doing something like that as well.
Well, you know, something that occurred to me when I was reading your new book, which is called Joan Crawford, A Woman's Face, Scott Iman, in case you didn't know what your book was called.
I still remember.
Yeah. You were talking in the book about the night that Carol Lombard died and that Clark Gable went to the arms of Joan Crawford, but they didn't have sex. They just cuddled. And
yeah, he was crying. He cried. He was sobbing. He was hysterical.
And I was thinking, I know that you are correct. I'm sure that you are, but I'm thinking, how does he know? What kind of research do you do when you're writing these books, Scott Iman? What do you, you have interviews, you have tax records, you know, what kinds of things do you look at to find out what happened and who did what?
It depends on the book. Every book has to be built from the ground up, and each book presents a specific set of problems that you probably have never encountered before. In terms of the Gable story, Crawford told that story herself in her memoir.
Yeah.
And I believe it. I believe it. They had a strong connection. They'd had an affair in the early 30s when she was married to Douglas Fairbanks and he was married to whoever he was married to at the time before Lombard. And they'd have a brief thing. They never thought about getting married because it wouldn't have worked because they were too much alike. As I say, they're both blue collar kids with no education who regarded themselves as mutts that were lucky to have been adopted out of the pound by MGM. And they had they had the same insecurities, and they both were absolutely commanding on the screen, but they had the same insecurities as human beings, which is almost never going to work because in a marriage, your insecurities have to balance each other off, you know. But each book presents a specific set of problems. I've a couple times, once or twice, I've had too much material. The DeMille book, I mean, I could have written two volumes on Cecil B. DeMille, but I don't think the world is waiting for two volumes on Cecil B. DeMille. DeMille was, DeMille knew he was important. He acted as if he was important, and he maintained his estate as if he was important, and he was important. There's everything of Cecil B. DeMille's that survives. His parents' love letters, right up to notes he was making a week or two before he died. Everything is preserved. Every conference, every script conference, every letter he wrote, it's all there. So that was a question of, what do I use? How do I create a narrative out of this incredible mass of material? That was one of the few times I had way too much material for one book, but I had to be really strict about the narrative. Otherwise it was going to get out of control very easily. Sometimes with The Speed of Sound, the book about the coming of sound, I went to the Western Electric archives, which were very helpful. But a lot of trade paper stuff, a lot of stuff came out of the trade papers of the period, Variety and Motion Picture Daily. And there were three or four others that were being published who were covering the transition from silence to sound. I used a lot of that stuff. And there are some times when you think this is thin. This is thin. I've got to come up with more stuff. Crawford. A lot of Crawford's papers were dispersed in auctions after her death. So there isn't as much correspondence in it as I usually use, because there isn't that much that survived. On the other hand, and this is fortuitous, most of her correspondence was thank you notes and keeping in touch with people. And she didn't write that many intimate, emotionally revealing letters. She didn't have that much time, because she had to write 50 letters a day, or dictate 50 letters a day, more likely. Her letters tended to be one piece of paper, half the size, and two or three paragraphs, and out. So there wasn't as much correspondence as I used in the DeMille book, because there isn't that much. It's dispersed. I used some stuff that I found, some stuff on the internet that I found. The intimacy came from finding people that knew her, which also gets to be a problem because she's been dead almost 50 years. Yeah. And people that knew Joan Crawford are getting a little thin on the ground. People are still writing books about Abraham Lincoln, and there's nobody to talk to. So if that can be done, I assume I can at least make another 5 or 10 years, if my legs last that long, to keep doing what I'm doing. Even as the herd thins, of available people. But it's always a problem. It's always been a problem. My first book was about Mary Pickford, and Mary Pickford died in 1972. She'd been dead for a while. And I had the same problem. There weren't that many people to talk to at that point when I was doing my book, which was about 8 years after she died. 8-9 years after she died. You can usually find something. There's a lot of oral history stuff at USC, at the Academy, of course, UCLA, the Library of Congress. I used a lot of stuff at the Library of Congress for the Chaplin book. All the government side of the thing came out of the Library of Congress. You develop certain research skill sets that I would never have dreamt of 30 years ago, 35 years ago, out of necessity. Where can I find something that addresses this problem in the book? And you think about it, and you think about it, and you make a couple calls, and by God, there's some librarian somewhere that will come up with it. I mean, the most interesting interview I found in my Cary Grant book, I found at the University of Wyoming library. Now, I had no idea it was there. I was browsing on the web, and there was a couple of Cary Grant items from a reporter who had interviewed him. So I called, and they got it to me, and it was fast. It was a transcript, I'd say 6 or 8 page transcript of an interview with Cary Grant. And he was just before he left to shoot To Catch a Thief in France. And he's bitching through the whole thing, just furious about the perils of being a movie star, and people don't understand what how rough it is and how much stressful how stressful it is, and you can't walk down the street without getting assaulted by autograph seekers. You can't do this, you can't go shopping, you can't do that. A litany of grief. And this is Cary Grant in 1953-54, just before he's going off to work in a Hitchcock picture, which he knows is going to be good. Because the script is good, Hitchcock is good, Grace Kelly's good, it's in Technicolor, it can't go wrong. And all he's doing is bitching. And it gave me such insight into why he was married five times. It can't be easy being around someone on a continuing basis who only sees the difficulties of being a movie star and focuses on that rather than on the benefits of being a movie star or some combination of both, you know?
Yeah. Interesting. Well, do you employ fact checkers, or do you have a staff that helps you with your
research? I have a researcher. I have a wonderful researcher for the last five books, Will Coates. I wouldn't work without him. He's extraordinary. He finds stuff that I don't even know exists. You know, I just give him a vague outline of what I want, and the stuff starts filtering back, you know, 3 weeks later, 3 months later, a year later, it just it shows up. And he just has this basset hound nose for material because he's a researcher and a librarian himself. So he knows the field and he knows how to find stuff. He's extraordinary. He's absolutely extraordinary. And I wouldn't work without him. If anything ever happens to him, I'm done.
And so your next book, a biography of Jack Oakey, coming out.
No, I passed on that. Oh. I passed. That was offer. It was a big money offer. And I thought about it because he is, you know, Benzino Napoloni, after all. But I just passed on it because it's too weighty a figure for me. I need something easier at this stage in my life.
So what will it be?
I don't know yet. I'm still circling. I've got a good idea. I've got a couple good ideas. I just have to make my mind up.
Well, I'm sure it'll take you at least a month to write it, and then I'll ask you to come back.
No, it'll take much longer than that. It's going to take 3 or 4 years.
Oh,
this is the one I think I'm going to do. It'll be 3 or 4 years.
Well, I hope we'll talk before then.
I hope I'm still alive.
Me too. I think that we both feel that way. Well, Scott Eyman, thank you, as always, for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Happy to do it, Gary. Call me anytime.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.